Hang on, just going to check my 12 o'clock.
He's checking his 12 o'clock.
12 o'clock again.
I think you'll find I've got an appointment at 12 o'clock. The appointment is with the gain management people of my microphone office building.
You know, I know we did the big apology about the Lord of the Rings mystical...
Yeah.
Never to be heard.
Yeah.
I haven't heard it back and I would...
No.
It's... Can I listen to it, though?
You can listen to it. It's legible, yeah. It's legible. There's one rule, though, of you listening.
What?
The rule is that you don't go, oh, this sounds fine, we should release it.
No, I wouldn't. You know, I know about your special ears.
Don't say you wouldn't. It's exactly the sort of thing you would do. I'm warning you now not to. That's all that's happening.
Look, listen, I know you've already said, you put your reputation on the line. You said it sounded shit. And I know about your special ears and how sound...
matters.
It's very important to you.
It is.
I think you could be... You could be like in a kind of a kooky hero of some indie film. The boy who heard differently.
I think they made that film. I think Edgar Wright made it, and it was sort of interesting. But
oh my god,
it wasn't really that good. What's it called?
Baby Driver.
Baby Driver. Yeah,
really bad. No, he had tinnitus.
It was bad. Well, he had hearing problems. I don't think it was just tinnitus. I think he had partial deafness, didn't he?
No, it was tinnitus and the music.
He lived with an old deaf man. He could sign.
Yeah, that's because I think he was always trying to block sound out because of the... Do you know what? I've realised... I don't know why. This is very late in the day for me to realise.
Mm.
But I've always felt that I like to figure out an argument as I'm having it.
Yes.
Right.
And that's you, yeah. That's what it'll say on your gravestone. Adam Richmond, here lies, beloved father, beloved husband, loved to figure out an argument as he was having it. That's what it would say.
Which I think it's driven many people away, and that's okay. Mm, it's sad, but I probably could have figured out to soften it. But I thought I was holding on to this idea that it was a pure thing.
Right.
But... very recently, I was down the pub and this happened. I was figuring out what I was thinking.
Live in the moment.
4 pints in as well.
Okay.
And it turned very sour.
Oh, dear.
but then I realized I didn't want it to. And I rolled it right back in.
Right.
And I extended the olive branch of apology. The olive branch of apology.
Yeah.
And then as I was talking and reflecting how I'd got us to that situation, I realized that in the course of, you know, discovering what I think, there's always like a key, there'll be a key thing I say, there'll be an anchor point in the argument that never changes or I'll refuse to kind of waver on. So if at any point that's under threat, the whole like trying to figure out what I think thing kind of goes to pieces.
Sure.
Because it's all rested on this like poisonous seed.
A millstone. The millstone of your toxicity.
So, and then that's what I just did to you. I just decided to say, I can't even remember what you said. My instant response was no. And then I was gonna go forth, and then yeah. Anyway,
I have to say no. I mean, let's linger for a moment because I know the listener now cares deeply about you and your sort of emotional progression. I think we've seen a lot of evolution of your emotional intelligence over the last year, and I'm not surprised to hear this story because let me tell the listeners, Adam Richmond, you text me. You were still with them. They must have gone to the toilet or the bar. You couldn't even wait to get home before you text me to say you've reeled it in. You've had a breakthrough. You've stopped it happening. And I thought, hey, man, that guy is proud of himself. And so he should be. Yeah. Well done to you. What age are you? 40, mid-40s?
42.
You can teach an old dog new tricks. They always said you can't. But you can, as long as it's the dog teaching itself.
There you go. Yeah, the old dog, you know, so there's no teaching. Just the old dog needs to learn. He can learn new tricks, but he has to teach himself.
Well, yeah, that's teaching an old dog new tricks, isn't it?
No, because who's... Is it?
Well, the dog is. The old dog is.
Do you teach yourself stuff?
If I taught myself something...
Or do you learn?
Then I would think, well, this man... I can teach this man a thing or two.
I can teach this Joe Devine a thing or two.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to accept that. Everything, every fibre of my being wants to,
I know.
You know, make it...
I know. But this is part of the journey, man. It's like you've got to sit on that stuff as well. And even you even have to hold it in when I say the thing I'm about to say.
Right.
There is a fan noise in your background.
Oh, shit. No, yeah, good. Oh, this would have been unusable.
Okay. And it's not easy for a man to hear that there's a fan noise in his background.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host. And Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond, and joining me as ever... in remembrance of all things cinematic, is the old leaky bucket boy, Mr. Joe Devine.
Hello there.
This is the show in which we talk about the films we'd forgot we'd even seen in the first place. Today, we are going to do the 1999. The 1999.
Your favourite year of cinema.
Hey, don't jump ahead.
Okay.
But yeah.
But yeah.
It's not my favourite year. It is mooted as up there amongst the great years, and we will.
Right.
I'll list about 20 films.
Okay.
Most years don't even have, I don't know, 3 or 4. Yeah,
true.
It's the 1999 caper flick directed by John McTiernan, the Thomas Crown Affair, starring Pierce Bronholm and René Rousseau,
yes,
featuring Dennis Leary. It's directed by John McTiernan of Die Hard fame and Predator and Hunt for Red October fame. And it's 113 mins.
113?
113 mins. It felt a lot longer than that.
153, baby.
And here's the letterboxed. How do you get the man who has everything?
Right, yeah.
Oh, how do you get the man who has everything? That's a lovely play on words. As opposed to, what do you get the man with everything?
Right, yeah.
I think that's what it's playing with. Do you think that's what it's playing with?
I think so. I think it's playing with that, but it's also playing with the notion that in this context, how to get him means two different things. Do you wish to woo him for romantic reasons? Oh. Or do you wish to capture him as a result of your professional requirement?
Oh, yeah. That's rich, man.
It's rich.
Oh, and a very rich... Here we go. Back to the overview.
Mm.
A very rich and successful playboy amuses himself by stealing artwork, but may have met his match in a seductive
detective.
Oh, where are you getting that from?
I'm reading that on IMDb at the same time as you.
Listen, Letterboxd, I'm the host.
Yes.
How
I know,
dare
but
you?
I thought it'd be fun if we said seductive detective together.
Yeah, but I just stopped there.
Yeah, you stopped.
I was
you didn't
so
see it
outraged.
From... Yeah.
Okay, there's some very, there's things wrong with that. He's not a playboy. He is a businessman. And she is not a detective.
No.
She is an insurance investigator. No,
sure,
no, no.
Sure.
Come on. Let's be input. Listen, words matter.
Okay, words matter.
Okay.
Yeah,
who's
bad.
The detective? Mm-hmm. Dennis Leary.
Dennis Leary, yeah.
And
as he keeps reminding everyone during the film, he is.
Does he?
She keeps calling him Lieutenant. And he keeps going, hey, it's detective.
Let's talk about who we were when we saw this film.
Yes.
Did you see it in the cinema?
No.
Because you're young in 1999, aren't you?
I'm young. But I had it on VHS. So I watched it on VHS, I think, numerous times. I genuinely haven't seen this film for, I mean, maybe 20 years. But I had seen it numerous times as a teenager.
And there are certain parts of that videotape which would be probably just a big snowy blur now.
I would say the tape probably wore thin in an area or two, yeah. I just loved the heist scenes.
I want us to at some point to talk about Hollywood's attitudes to sex and nudity.
Yeah.
I said to you, I'd love it if we could do it without giggling like schoolboys. And I don't know whether that's going to be possible.
That's going to be hard for us, but we will try our best. And it's worth caveating all of that with we hope to have a serious conversation.
This film has a very healthy, a surprisingly un-Hollywood approach to nudity and sex, certainly for a mainstream film.
Yes.
And it treats both Rene Russo, if Brosnan's topless.
Mm-hmm.
Rene Russo's topless.
Yeah.
You see Brosnan's
a little, yeah, you see full bum.
And it's
when they have sex on the marble staircase, which I watched this with my wife and we both turned to each other and thought, that looks just really uncomfortable.
He is having sex with her thigh.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's got the Hollywood maths, like angles. What's the word for, when it comes to Hollywood sex scenes, the bits are never...
They're never aligned.
They're never aligned in the way that they are.
The eclipse never occurs.
It's like no one has sex like that.
No one could have sex like that.
No, you would be dry humping.
Sure.
A thigh,
yeah.
Or a butt cheek.
You'd accidentally be slapping a testicle against a cold marble staircase. I mean, that's not... Nobody wants this.
And you've got the juts of the staircase jutting in to your back.
It's just not good.
It's like shagging in a shower or in a bath.
Sure.
Where's no room for purchase.
No, nobody wants to do this. Also, in the bath, I know from myself, I'm a large set man. If I were to get in a bath, which, to be honest, I haven't actually done for over a decade, when you get in, the water displaces, yeah? If you have any kind of movement in the bath, particularly up and down movement in the bath, that the water is going everywhere, right? Another reason why only the wealthy are allowed to have sex in bathrooms, because A, the showers, the baths are not big enough in your average home, and also we just can't afford to waste that much water.
I love the idea about you saying displacement and sex in the bath. I'm trying to figure out, like, a sort of a shit joke, like, oh, the best thing about sex in the bath is that eureka moment. Do you know what I mean?
The eureka moment when you decide it's probably better to go to the bedroom.
Well, do you know what the eureka moment is?
When you say eureka, you have an idea.
Yeah, but the where it comes from is the man who said it, the Greek man, he got in the bath and the water raised, and that's how he figured about displacement and mass. And he was running through the town saying eureka.
Was he?
This is why I shouldn't. Also,
you're doing a real thing. This sounds like one of your weird bits.
No, that's true.
That's real.
That's, yeah, it's either...
It was a bath.
It's Aristotle or Pythagoras.
One of those Greeks.
It's one of those Greeks.
This sounds like a Newton and the apple.
It's exactly. It's one of those tales. I'm surprised you didn't know it.
I don't know it, no. I'm not a science guy, really.
You know, nor am I. I don't even know the guy's name. I can't.
Right.
I can't think of his name.
Pythagoras.
Mate, I was Archimedes.
Archimedes. Good old Archimedes.
Aristotle was a philosopher, so he wouldn't have been doing that kind of stuff. And he would have been dirty. Philosophers are dirty. They're not doing baths.
No, they're not bathing at all.
You know, that washes away the ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
They're very much, you know, mired in the muck.
They want to keep that filth on them, yeah?
Oh, it brings them closer to humanity and ideas.
That's right. Eureka, that stank.
Eureka, that stank.
Eureka, that stank. That's how you come up with all those ideas. You sit in the cave and look out at the shadows.
No, but the eureka was the math guy in the bath.
Did he come up with the word eureka?
Great question. I don't know whether it was a word he just invented or
if it was, and he got in the bath and the water rose. And he went, the theory of displacement. And then he ran around the town, presumably nude.
Yes,
he's just out of the bath.
That's the tale.
Dripping and shouting the made-up word eureka. No wonder all people in the past thought scientists were cuckoo-ca-choo.
Yeah, and they'd get they'd get killed, burned as witches, probably.
Yep.
We don't know anything about history or maths, which is why we're talking about the Thomas Crown Affair.
Yeah.
It's also this. It should add, it's a remake of a 60s flick that starred Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway. I've seen that. Not very good.
Sure.
You know, just thought I'd throw that in there. So you had this on video. So are you 13 when you're watching this?
I guess something like that. 12, 13, 14, 15. until the video
really,
wears
really
thin,
narrow yeah. it down. Narrow down the 13, 14. Could be anywhere between 13 and 18.
Wasn't legally allowed to work full time, but also I didn't need to be cared for 24/7 at home, you know?
Right. Okay. That's
somewhere in that middle area.
So yeah, and I'm seeing this at the cinema as well. Just saw it. We got it on DVD afterwards. DVDs don't wear out in the important places. No,
but they can scratch out.
Yeah, but why would you scratch out the good bits?
I mean, I was thinking when you were saying before that this film has a kind of very un-Hollywood approach to its sexuality and its themes of desire. The main thing I think about it is how sweaty all the sex scenes are. They're all really sweaty all the time. I mean, they're definitely being re-beaded between takes, aren't they? They've got a bead person. And I imagine during the Thomas Crown Affair, the remake, of course, they would have had to have a re-beader in order to reapply the dewy drops of sweat atop Brosnan and Russo's foreheads. Because no one wants to see dry marble staircase sex. They want to see their performers beaded, heavily beaded.
If you're making the porno parody of this, what are you calling it?
Oh, that's a really good question, yeah.
I'm going route one, the Thomas Bone Affair.
Right, yeah. I was thinking the Thomas Brown Affair.
We have
and
a winner.
Maybe he takes the artwork out the back door, you know.
No, but, I mean, listen, you were doing so well to spell out that amazing joke. You really fucked it. You had everyone in the palm of your hand, and then you had to. Oh dear, Joe. It's amazing how you can fly so high and then tumble so quickly.
Icarus and his waxy feet.
Oh.
Yeah. Another old scientist discovering things by trying.
Do you think Icarus really did that?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, it makes sense. Him and Icarus was a famous friend of the Wright brothers. And they had the competition, who can fly first? The Wright brothers kept saying, hey, Icarus, you built that shit out of wax, it's never going to work. And Icarus was like, hey, fuck you, Wright brother A. I'll show you.
Yeah.
And he did.
I was going to say, that's a nice point about rebeading.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy. There is a really nice moment when they're kind of horsing around. I think they've just shagged, and then they're going to go again. But it might just be a testament to what a great actress Renee Russo is, where she just laughs and
it's so real.
Yeah, yeah, and it kind of looks like they're horsing around. That is a very authentic sex moment that you don't really see in a Hollywood film. It's got all the other ludicrous stuff that you do see, the marble, you know, the stupid angles. But then in that, there's all this other stuff. So it's very strange. I find that's kind of a microcosm for why I struggled to watch this film again. I really was expecting to find it fun,
right,
as fun as I did over 20 years ago. And my memory of this was a clever, classy caper flick. And watching it again was a bit of a struggle. I was fairly bored for the whole middle section.
Sure.
The score was appalling. there's so many jarring different types of music for like different characters. Like the heist men at the beginning, who are Eastern European, have this whole horrible theme going on.
Yeah.
And then there's this soft jazz at other points. And I found it a real struggle.
Well, that's at its worst in René Rousseau's first scene as well. That the artwork has been stolen. You see this attractive woman standing in the background of a scene of male police officers all kind of talking amongst themselves. And she's introduced and suddenly the slap bass comes out of nowhere. I mean, it's almost parody.
It's wacka, yeah, wacka wacka.
Yeah, it's wacka wacka music. Sexy wacka wacka music. And I wrote down at that moment, this scene has not aged well. I then sort of expected to endure the entire film of a mixture of feeling guilty about how saucy I found it as a teenager, looking back on it now and thinking, oh God, maybe this is not a good representation of of sex in films. And then I was confused. As I said, I watched this with my wife and we had this conversation at the end. I think in this conversation, we might jump around a little bit because there are lots of different elements interwoven here that are relevant. And with that in mind, I watched a bunch of interviews with John McTiernan, where he talked about all of his films, but specifically with the Thomas Crown Affair. He said in one interview, he said he'd only ever made boys' adventure movies. That's all the films he's ever made are boys' adventure films, apart from the Thomas Crown Affair, which he described as a love story between two people who'd given up ever falling in love, both too capable, too hard, too cynical to ever fall in love. Now, after that first René Rousseau scene with the wacka wacka, sexy, saucy music and her, to be honest, like throughout the film, her her wardrobe is at times bizarre. I felt, as I said, I'm going to be watching a film here which is going to feel really dated, really aged, where its approach to how it represents women and the female characters does not stand up to today's standards. And then halfway through the film, my wife and I paused it and had a conversation about whether or not that was actually true. Because on the one hand, she is super, super sexualized. Like, it's an outrageously saucy film. And René Rousseau is right at the center of that. But on the other hand, she's made to be a match for Pierce Brosnan. As the director says there, they are two people who occupy this same kind of cynical approach to love. She's incredibly smart. She's the only one that can catch him. She's smarter than all the police people within the film. And she's the only other person on his level, right? So within the film, she uses her sexuality in order to initially try to get what she wants for professional reasons and then later for other reasons. But she's not a weak character. She's sort of an independent, powerful woman.
Yeah, and then also I think I don't think the film sexualizes her in the way that, say, a Michael Bay film sexualizes a Megan Fox, for example. Or the Fast and Furious films, where they just have the male gaze, women in bikinis objectifying their bodies. Because of the way the character's written in Thomas Crown Affair, she is a woman in control of her, you know, sexuality and using her body, and she's sexy because she's smart.
The film might be called The Thomas Crown Affair, but she's also clearly the protagonist.
She is. It feels quite progressive, but then, and then the very end, what's the opposite of progressive?
Regressive.
The very end is regressive, because the finale is Thomas Crown basically bringing her down, bringing her to an emotional low, making her cry, making her think that she's fucked everything up, and then like effectively playing a big trick on her. And then she apologizes and they get off on a plane. That's the only note, I think, I guess, sexual politics wise.
Yeah.
You said you enjoyed it.
Yes.
Just before we started recording. And we usually like to keep those kinds of things secret for surprise. And my instant internal, the little man in my head got angry at the fact that you'd enjoyed it. Because I thought, oh, for Christ's sake, we're going to have another Italian Job. We're going to have another Constantine. I'm getting sick of this dynamic.
Sure. this dynamic where I'm open to enjoying films that aren't good and where you're closed to enjoying anything but the best. I know.
Yeah. And so the little man said, what the fuck is Joe enjoying this film got to do with anything? Like, what has that got to do with it being good or not? Is it good or not?
Sure.
Hey, listen, I don't want to give that little man a platform. I'm just saying.
You kind of have, though. I mean, he's here now. He's in the text. And also, every time you say your little man, I do think you're talking about your penis.
And that is also fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this is a very sexual episode.
I like the notion of you going to the toilet, just going for a wee, love. And then you open the door, unzip, you get your penis out, you start weeing, and it goes, Joe enjoyed the film? How dare he? You make sure he knows that it wasn't a good film. And you go, okay, little man. You finish and you shake up. And he says, don't shake me. And then you get put back in the zip and you come and record the podcast. What about this then? Let me try one on for you. And I think you might be surprised.
Yeah? Okay.
You and your little man. You ready?
Yeah.
I think art is the perfect thing to be heisted in this film. And whilst it might not be explored completely or executed to perfection, the notion of a character going after something, stealing something, because in the original, you'll know because you've seen, the original is just a bank robbery. In this one, the character is stealing artwork, partly because they like art, but largely because old Pierce Brosnan, Thomas Crown, he likes living on the edge. He wants the feeling of doing it, right? And that, as a sort of concept, as an idea to build a film around, that really is, I like that. That's really interesting to me. I much prefer that he's stealing art than he is stealing gold or money or anything else.
Yeah, it's great. And I tell you what, I love that briefcase he's got.
Yeah.
There's a scene when, the opening scene, best scene in the film, when he slides the artwork into that briefcase and it kind of magically folds in half. It
yeah,
folds
how does that work?
It doesn't, but the film makes you believe
yeah.
that he's got a magic briefcase that can fold something in half without folding it in half.
It cuts from the beginning of the fold to him using the power of his shoulder to clearly snap the artwork in two as he's folding it. And then the film looks at you and goes, huh? Come on, what are you going to do about that? And you go, what can I do? I can't do anything about that. Am I allowed to do something about that? And the film goes, no, just carry on. And you go, okay.
This guy, he's slick. He has this briefcase. He's got a briefcase yeah. that can hold up one of those big, you know, steel barriers coming
yep.
down.
Yeah.
Security gates. It doesn't, the film has got that, you know, that kind of chutzpah, the vim and the vigor to go, hey, he's got this briefcase. Money, he's rich. He can make this happen.
Yeah.
He's got a Mary Poppins briefcase that can fold things without folding them.
And doubles as a heater, as you later find.
That's when when things start to get a little bit, you're kind of over-egging this pudding about how much this briefcase can do.
Sure,
I bought
sure.
that it could fold something without folding it.
Yeah.
But now it's got a heater in there.
Yeah, it's got a heater that can up the degrees of the room by 10 Fahrenheit, though. Who knows what the hell is happening with Fahrenheit? That could be nothing. 10 degrees Fahrenheit could be 1 degree. Who could say?
Yeah. What do you think about the dynamic? See, instead of you telling me what you like about it, let's just ask questions about what was going on in the film.
Okay.
You tell me.
Yeah.
What did you think about the relationship between Dennis Leary, the detective,
yes.
and René Russo, and the relationship and how it compares to the relationship between Russo and Brosnan?
Yes.
The sexy one.
Mm-hmm.
And Russo. And who she fancies and who she doesn't fancy. Do you think there's sure. anything in that?
I think at least there is supposed to be something in that. Because, of course, the final scene that features both Dennis Leary and René Russo, the artwork has been found, the second piece has been stolen, they're saying their goodbyes. Dennis Leary has realised within himself that she's off to Brozza's, right? She's out of there. And he's kind of giving her, not that it's required, but he's sort of giving her his blessing. She gives him two little kisses on the mouth. And I turned to my wife and I said, oh, that's some mixed messages, you know. Because throughout the film we hear, of course, Dennis Leary's life not going very well. He's been divorced. He lives alone. He's not very successful. He's being outshone as a detective, his primary professional responsibility, by an investment investigator who's an insurance investigator, who's just shown up, is dressed all cool, is drinking these you know, vegetation liquid greeny fruity you know, mineral drinks in the morning, and then is just able to pull incredible observations out of her ass on a daily basis. His life is not going well. But he looks at her and he lusts after her. He fancies her. He wants her as well.
He asks her out on a date.
She's not interested because guess what? She has to deal with these kind of idiots all the time. Her job is going around and then being a bit like, listen, police person, yeah? The real fucking popo has shown up now. I'm the one who's looks after the money. I'm the one who gets the real shit done. I'm the private version of you. This is an American film after all, and therefore I'm being paid more equals I'm better. The point I'm making is that when she kisses him at the end of the film, the suggestion there is, as my wife said to me, he's the kind of man that she should fancy, but of course she doesn't, you know? And I said, yes, dear.
Yeah, so that's one of those annoying, she wants the asshole.
It's not really explored, though, is it? It's not really part of the film. They can't, like, he asks her on a date, and then they have that at the end. In the middle, it's not really a thing.
No, but it's that's the subtext of the film, is like,
yeah.
Pricks win.
Pricks get picks, yeah.
So if you're sexy Pierce Brosnan and you're aloof and you steal art and you're very evasive about what you're doing,
yeah,
or the ladies love it.
Well, of course they do. Now let me ask you a question, Adam. Okay, have you ever seen Pierce Brosnan be better in any other film?
I have seen him in better films. No, GoldenEye.
No. Seen him in better films. You think he's done a better performance elsewhere?
He's perfect in GoldenEye.
I think he's perfect in this. I think this suits him better than GoldenEye.
But the pursing, the lip pursing.
Mm-hmm. I love the lip pursing.
Do you know what I mean?
I want to see it more. If he was able to purse and talk, I'd say do that, Pierce.
He's good. I thought we could maybe talk for a bit about Brosnan, but I don't think there's enough in the locker. He was in one of the best Bond films,
GoldenEye.
And then he was subsequently in some of, basically the rest of the worst ones.
Yeah.
He got horribly served as Bond. And
well, he had an interesting period as Bond, though, didn't he? Because, as you said, GoldenEye, one of the great films, also happened to have a video game that a whole generation of people adored. So I think that kind of helps nurse the nostalgia around GoldenEye. But when he came in, was it Timothy Dalton they replaced?
It was. It'd been a sizable break. Yeah, Dalton had failed, really. I think he did Daylights and License to Kill.
Yeah.
License to Kill, Bond. And then that was it. Bond was done for ages.
Yeah. But also, Pierce Brosnan helped in GoldenEye. He helped bring Bond out of the you know, the sort of, if you think of Bond as a kind of spectrum between silliness at one end and then like super kind of, you know, dark, like how would you talk about the Daniel Craig Bond as quite dark, quite gravelly is not the word, gritty, you know, cold.
Brosnan, the 90s Bond, he brought back just fun action film that wasn't stupid.
Sure.
Like a Roger Moore one.
Yeah, yeah.
And they got Judi Dench in as M, and it kind of it faced up to like the chauvinism of the 50s Bonds.
I think the thing that interests me about it, because obviously Pierce Brosnan, I realized when I was watching this film, I know him extremely well from the Thomas Crown Affair and from those James Bond films, you know, pre James Bond. I don't really know who Pierce Brosnan was, what he was doing, how he was considered. I only know him post-Bond.
I'd recommend The Matador and The Tailor of Panama.
Okay.
His best performance is The Tailor of Panama.
Right.
That's where he takes on and in kind of plays and inverts what he did with Bond.
Is that pre-Bond, post-Bond?
That's post-Bond.
That's post-Bond.
Or it might be during, like you said, because you're saying Thomas Crown Affair was...
Thomas Crown Affair was at the peak of Bond. I mean, his final Bond film was 2001, something like that. So, I mean, he'd made two or three Bond films when he started to make the Thomas Crown Affair, which I find really interesting because there's always something interesting about the sorts of films and projects that the Bond actor agrees to take on during their tenure as Bond. And most of the time, they are films that don't resemble the James Bond character. But in this instance, whilst obviously Thomas Crowley's not James Bond, he is an extremely wealthy, mysterious, aloof bachelor character who has got all these skills to do things that, you know, he's a bit like a spy and all the girls like him and whatever, and he's rich and he's as part of the sort of and sort of not part of the establishment. I mean, it's just in that instance, it's quite an interesting choice to make if you're already James Bond to say, actually, I want to be Thomas Crown as well.
I think there's a Venn diagram whereby, you know, he's sexy and confident and can take care of business. But I just think it's more speaks to Brosnan's wheelhouse. I think the character's different enough from Bond.
Yeah.
And I don't think people are like, oh yeah, can we have a different flavor of Brosnan, please? And they're like, yeah, sure. Thomas Crown Affair. I'd say the other
Neapolitan great- Brosnan. Brosnan, that would be if Thomas Crown had a flavor, it's Neapolitan for sure.
Yeah.
Whereas Bond is just vanilla.
Well, no. Wait a minute. Vanilla's the best. Neapolitan, yeah. It works because Neapolitan's a sandwich. And this film, Crown is a sandwich.
Yeah.
Got a lovely chocolate starter. The middle is this disgusting,
strawberry,
horrible
strawberry
that goes on for too long. And then you've got a lovely little slice of vanilla at the end.
Right.
And there is another good, really underrated Brosnan film called Seraphim Falls. And he's really good in that. He barely talks in it. No time to purse his lips. Mm. It's just him. It's a Western. And Liam Neeson is chasing him through the wilderness.
I mean, that does sound good.
It's really good.
I'll check that out.
So, you know, you tell me Thomas Crown Affair. I think you need to see more Brosnan films.
Okay. One more Bond observation before we move on then. I read I don't know if it would be fair to call it a rumor, a theory. Someone somewhere said this once. I don't know whether it's true, but it's a fun, neat little idea. You know, the scene, the black and white ball scene in Thomas Crown Affair, when Rene Russo shows up wearing her black see-through dress and her red sort of scarf drape thing. And Pierce Brosnan says, it's a black and white ball.
And it's not says, Sean Connery.
Well, I've always liked to be different or something. I don't know. And then they do this strange, sexy, incredibly sexy dance with everyone's bum is everywhere. Remember that bit?
Do I remember that bit?
Do you remember that bit?
Do I remember that bit? I don't know what bit you're talking about.
The point is, I don't know if you remember or not, but Pierce Brosnan is wearing a tux with a white bow tie, but the bow tie is open. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
And I really love that detail because I think, God, this party's been going on for a while. He's so confident and calm and so very rich that he's going to be dancing. This man's going to have his bow tie open. Yeah. He's no slouch. He doesn't need to tie it up. He doesn't care what the world thinks of him. Yeah. Anyway, I read that one of the potential reasons why he had to have his bow tie open because his Bond contract stipulated that he wasn't allowed to wear tuxedos, complete tuxedos with bow ties, in any other media while he was playing as James Bond. So I love the idea that somewhere, someone on that scene, ahead of that set, had to say, fine, he can have the ball, but he can't have his bow tie tied. That's great.
It doesn't even feel like anything close to...
No, it doesn't. Right?
...traditional black tie.
Yeah, it doesn't.
So, yeah, I mean, I love... That sounds like a fun, very believable theory.
I hope that's true, and I love to imagine the day or two when a lawyer, a production assistant, you know, somebody had to work that out, had to talk to wardrobe, the director got involved, and then the director would have thought, well, actually, this is useful anyway because I don't want anyone thinking of Bond during this scene, so let's do... And then what I see is just a lovely detail that he has his bow tie open might be the result of this super cool, efficient, nuanced legal requirement, which also created art, you know? So who's to say that the lawyers can't be part of the creative process?
I mean, this isn't art. Let's do 1999.
Y2K, baby.
Is that...
Hey, because you have you heard of the Millennium Bug?
So this is just a smattering of the titles that are coming out in 1999 and why some people like to think it is up there with the great cinematic years.
Hit me with them.
Fight Club.
Oof.
The Matrix.
Yes, please.
Magnolia.
Bingo, Bango, Bongo.
The Sixth Sense.
Yep, fair enough.
The Virgin Suicides.
I See Dead People.
Oh, well, that's quite a clever joke, that. Election.
I don't know why it's a clever joke, but thank you for...
Well, because you should have said it after The Sixth Sense.
Yeah, I was just one behind. I was one behind, you know?
Yeah, but then Virgin Suicides, yeah. So
oh,
worked.
Because of the suicides.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was just... I thought I'm going to say this anyway, regardless of... I didn't even hear what you said. I just heard you made a noise, and then I said, I see dead people.
Right. It's a shame, because that was really clever.
Shit. Yeah. What was the next one?
Election.
Oh, I do like that one with Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah.
My cousin Helen's favourite film.
Existenz.
Still haven't seen that, but I did listen to an edit the other day of you getting really excited about that.
Toy Story 2.
Oh, one of the finest songs in any film is in that. It's When She Loved Me, the one that's sung from the perspective of Jessie the cowgirl. That is...
You said you'd say one word.
Sorry.
Try and say that.
That's
sentence.
Just an absolutely fantastic song.
No, wait. Okay. I'm going to say Toy Story 2. We've heard the sentiment. I'm going to keep it in.
Let's do it, yeah.
But go back to your rules. Mm-hmm. Encapsulate that whole really long sentence.
Can I have four
word.
Words? Four words? Huh? Four words?
Okay, four words.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Okay, go.
Toy Story 2.
When she loved me.
The Insider. Rusty Crow, Al Pacino. Michael Mann directed, phenomenal film.
I don't know if I've ever seen that.
It's phenomenal.
I was thinking, I'm thinking of Inside Man with Denzel Washington and
you are.
Someone else.
The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Oh, yes, please.
Eyes Wide Shut.
I still haven't seen it. It's on my list, but every time I go to watch it, or any, I have the same thing with, what's the name of his other film? Not Barry Leopard.
Barry Lyndon.
Barry Lyndon. I always think, I really need to watch Eyes Wide Shut and Barry Lyndon. And once or twice a year, I'll go, oh, I'm going to do that tonight. And then I get them up on whatever streaming service they're there. And I go, oh, they're 3.5 hours long. I won't watch that now.
Skip Eyes Wide Shut, but you've got Barry Lyndon is fantastic. I'd never seen it. And then I managed to see it at the cinema.
Right.
At the Berlin Film Festival. Yeah, it would never have been a film I would have put on for those reasons. Like, oh, it's long and some Kubrick's work and some don't. And it's great.
I'm going to give it a roll. I'm going to give it a hey roll.
If it comes on at the Prince Charles...
Check it out.
Do it there.
Okay.
You know, it's fantastic.
That's a good shout. I mean, because the last time that I delayed watching a 3-hour-plus movie for years was JFK. And I finally watched that last year. And boy, what a movie.
What a picture. What a lovely piece of propaganda that was. Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai.
I do not know what that is.
It's Jim Jarmusch.
Oh, okay.
Forrest Whitaker. It's good.
Right.
It's good.
Ghost Dog.
The Hurricane.
The Hurricane. No, I remember Twister. Is it anything like Twister?
No, it's a boxing picture with Denzel Washington.
Right, okay.
Who you claim to love.
I do like Denzel Washington. But as discussed in the previous episode, how quickly are you allowed to say love? For me, it's pretty quick. For you, it takes longer.
Being John Malkovich.
I do love that film.
All About My Mother.
I've never heard of that.
It's Pedro Almodovar.
Oh, Almodovar.
Almodovar.
You say Almodovar, don't you? And I always think Almodovar. And I say Almodovar.
I just
how would they say it in the accent? It would be Pedro Almodovar. Pedro Almodovar. They would say Almodovar, wouldn't they? They would.
This is Joe, one word divine at his finest. Blair Witch, Blair Witch Project.
Yep.
And Boys Don't Cry, end on a downer.
Boys Don't Cry.
Hilary Swank.
Oh, yes. I watched that film as a teenager on the TV. I sort of had no understanding of the context, didn't know it was a big deal or anything. And remember thinking, this is scary.
It's a really powerful. It's not that kind. It's the kind of film I wouldn't choose to put on now.
Sure.
I'm really glad I saw it, and I would probably give it another go.
Yeah. She won an Oscar for it, didn't she?
I don't know. I tell you what. Speaking of Swank,
Maybe she won it for Million Dollar Baby.
One of those retrospectives. She should have won it for Boys Don't Cry.
She did. She did win it for Boys Don't Cry. Hilary Swank. Pretty good, isn't it? Let me see if she won the other one as well. She also won a Best Performance by an Actress in a Leading Role, 2005 Million Dollar Baby. So she won two in the space of 5 years, but she did win for Boys Don't Cry.
She's totally slept on now. There was a big gap where she wasn't in anything, and I think it's one of those things, Hollywood sexism, ageism, when an actress gets too old.
Well, they do. I mean, perhaps to a certain generation, the most famous Hilary Swank bit is the bit in The American Office where they spend the entire episode sat around divided into two groups of who thinks she's attractive and who thinks she's hot.
Yeah, and then that's a big joke, is it?
Yeah.
That's a big joke, is it, today? Unfucking believable.
That's the one. That's the joke.
Let's just objectify someone who is really, really talented. Fuck The American Office. You can go fuck yourself.
You're looking for reasons to be upset with The American Office.
No, I'm not.
That's the kind of guy you are.
She pops up in Logan Lucky. We didn't even talk about her. She's good. She's good fun in that. She's good value.
Oh yeah, she's the detective at the end.
And she's really decent in a Netflix sci-fi flick called I Am Mother, which I quite liked. What was the last big film?
I would say P.S. I Love You was quite a big. That was a rom-com, right?
Yeah. She's in a couple of stinkers.
With Gerard Butler.
Yeah.
Swank and Butler together. That's quite fun, isn't it?
Those 2 years, she had Freedom Writers and P.S. I Love You, and they both were kind of considered a bit stinko.
Although it made a lot of money, P.S. I Love You.
Right. I guess it's considered, it was a bit of a joke shit film and it got shat on, but maybe just people will go and see any old...
Maybe the box office is just different for those sorts of films.
Should we watch P.S. I Love You?
Yeah, I mean, should we do that and then have it as an adjunct to whatever next episode is?
Absolutely.
Let's do it. Hopefully we'll remember that we said that.
I'm not letting you forget.
Okay, well, good luck.
I want to watch it. I love Jerry Butler.
Yeah, I like...
I love Swank.
I like Swank and Butler.
I want to see what the chemistry's like.
Can we call them Swutler? Or back, blank, blank?
No. Let's call them, I don't like when people smash words together.
You don't like portmanteau?
I don't like these portmanteaus. Brangelina, like nonsense.
But yeah, but
grow up.
Brangelina is a bit rubbish, but blank is quite fun.
Why blank?
Butler and Swank.
Oh, okay.
Boo-wank would make more sense. Boo-wank would make more sense, yeah. A boo-wank is something you do after you've watched a horror film.
Or Swankler. Surely Swankler.
Yeah, Swankler's pretty good. Swankler's pretty good. I don't know, yeah.
I was reading a commentary that Magritte himself actually wrote about this painting, and in this commentary, he discusses, first of all, the main aspect here, the surrealist aspect of this painting, is that the apple, it hides the face at least partially. We have the apparent face of this individual. We have the apple. The face is somewhat visible. So we have the apple hiding the visible, yet at the same time, it is also hidden. It's the face of the person, both visible and hidden at the same time. It's something that happens constantly, Magritte believed, where everything we see hides another thing, something else. And we always want to see what's hidden by what we see. And Magritte truly believed, as did many of the surrealists, that this fundamental principle of human nature was going to be, or needed to be, one of the driving forces in art. The interest in seeing what is hidden or what is blocked by the visible is a very intense feeling. It's a sort of human conflict, we believe, that one might say, between the visible that is hidden and the visible that is present.
This film has got a clever ending, Joe.
Yeah.
It's got a fun little clever ending. Like,
I know about the ending. I've read about it.
Oh, well, I was going to hopefully move away from the film and just talk more broadly about clever endings. What have you read about the clever ending?
The film opens with this wonderful scene of him stealing a painting, yeah? In a very creative way.
A Monet.
Anyway, a Monet.
A big one.
A wealthy painting. Wealthy? The painting had a lot of wealth. Its net wealth was high on account of stocks that it had bought. And then 2 days later, ever the hero, Brozes donates a painting back to the museum to hang in its place, you know, until the original is located. Anyway, later in the film, the ending is he says he's going to put the painting back in. So he shows up at the museum dressed in a bowler hat like in The Son of Man, the apple in the face painting. Confusion ensues. But all he has to do is set the sprinklers off, because guess what? The Monet has been back in the painting since about a day or two after he stole it.
Back in the painting?
It's been back in the museum.
Back in the slot.
It's the third it's time the I'm trying to do this bit. The point is, he already put it back ages ago, and then the sprinkler system does the thing where it washes away.
Stop.
Stop.
The painting he donated has got it's water based, and the sprinklers wash it away. Apparently, they don't
water paint.
They don't. That water doesn't damage the Monet.
Yeah, it does though, for sure, doesn't it? That's a little plot hole.
For sure, destroys.
Because if it didn't, then why would the shatters shut all the other paintings away? Yeah, he's put his pencils in there. They say Thomas Crown on them. No one's noticed them for a month. The point is, it's a clever, cool ending.
And yeah? Cinnamon. Nina Simone's Cinnamon is playing all over it. The claps you've heard throughout, it's been teasing the piano motif and the claps. It's been teased, and it finally explodes, and you finally hear Nina Simone
say, "Where you gotta run to?"
And it's a good moment.
It's a fantastic moment. Now, let me tell you what John McTiernan said about the ending. Would you like to know?
Just tell me, because I'm going to cut you asking that question.
I like it to ask you, though.
Otherwise, it's just me saying yes.
Because it builds a bit of tension.
It doesn't.
Yeah, I'm going like, would you like it? And you're like, yeah. And then the audience are going, God, he wants it. I'm never ever going to say no, am I? I don't know. You might say no. You're the kind of person who would say no.
I'm sorry. I don't want to hear that.
No, here's what John McTiernan says about it. Of course, in the furore around the Monet being returned, Adam, another painting is stolen. And John McTiernan, the director, said of the original script, there were 30 pages dedicated to how Thomas Crown stole the second painting. And his contribution to that was to say, get rid of this. This is all very boring stuff, like including how Pierce Brosnan was kind of coming down from the ceiling on ropes to get it and tricking the cameras and the heat sensors and all of this stuff. He said, replace all of that with one cop pointing at the empty bit of wall and saying, how the hell did he do that? And another one saying, I don't know, you know? And that's great. That's a really fun bit of the ending. It doesn't need explaining. There's no point explaining it. We've already seen loads of stuff in the film that doesn't make any sense. And the film doesn't care, and I don't care either. So I just love the notion that where once there was another 15 minutes, he's gone, we'll do it all within the space of Cinnamon, and then we'll move on.
That's why John McTiernan is a great director. He gets it. And he is. This is the man who directed Die Hard, Predator, Hunt for Red October, Die Hard with a Vengeance, which I rewatched that last week. That film it's near perfect. It's almost as good as Die Hard. And anyone who says otherwise doesn't know what they're talking about.
Now, box office game for the Thomas Crown Affair. We're going to start with the brackets estimated for the budget. What do you reckon? This was, of course, August 1999.
This is a toughy-wuffy.
And I'm going to give you the toughy-wuffy extension here.
They're spending money on it. It's got stars in it. It's filmed on location.
Yep.
But then at the same time, it doesn't have a huge amount of action. Okay, so let's say $80 million.
$80 million, you say? Okay, well, it wasn't quite that much. It was $48 million.
Okay.
Pretty good.
Yeah, 50, 60. Yeah, no, that's a nice, I think it's going to be doing well. I think it's washing its face to jump ahead. But go on, let's get on to the next bit.
Well, let's see if it does wash its face. Now, it was a toughy-wuffy. We allowed that. Opening weekend US and Canada, August the 8th. What do you think? It's a summer blockbuster. It's not that, but, you know, it was released in the summer. What can a film like this take?
A couple of mil. I feel like it's going to... a healthy couple of mil. 50, sexy stars.
It's got James Bond in it.
I think it's going to make 15 million.
Oh, 14 mil, 0.6. Look at that.
There we go.
Very close.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, let's move on to the final guess. Gross worldwide. How much did this film take? Gross worldwide.
World. I think it's doing well. It's going to have legs because I think it was fairly well reviewed. It's probably getting 3 stars across the board. Is it going to break 100? Is it going to double its money?
Does it go over 100? That's the question.
I'm going to go under. Let's say 98 million.
It did go over, Adam.
Oh, did it go to 120?
It went over by some means. It went to 124. Very close to being rounded up to 125, but $124 million. That's a big success.
Absolutely. It is a big success.
Congratulations to everyone involved.
Should we do the game, the bit of the podcast where we do the game where one of us reads out a list of films to try and catch the other one out for a movie they forgot?
What about Passengers with Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence?
Man, that's a turd that just won't get flushed. I think we have to do Passengers.
Mm.
I know back in the mists of us recording, I think you tried to get me on it and I batted it away.
You didn't actually. You accepted it and then I freaked out because I didn't want to watch it again. So I then moved on. We made a sort of a tacit agreement that it would come back at some point. And here it is. The turd that won't flush. Passengers.
It's sci-fi. It's different, man. We've been on a run of con heist caper shit.
Yeah.
So let's do it. Okay, so that was the Thomas Crown Affair. Say bye, Joe.
Bye, Joe.